Hey there, and welcome to episode number 152 of Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is December 1970. My name is Brian Stratton.
And mine is Jamie Wenger.
No Rob tonight.
Boo.
He's got the next couple of weeks off. He's earned it. We've worked him pretty hard lately.
Yeah, so. I guess that's fair.
Designing logos and t-shirts and all sorts of branding materials and whatnot.
The occasional musical number.
Yeah, doing all the music and then, you know, mastering all the episodes. So, yeah, I guess he snuck out, but we're not going to pursue him too hard. We're just going to hope that he comes back.
I was actually hoping with him gone that I might get taller. I thought there was like a stable mass but it didn't really work that way. I'm still still way down here.
Not how biology works, unfortunately. But I don't know. Maybe you'll get bit by a radioactive Rob. And that would give you the proportionate height of a Rob. I don't know.
You're hoping either way.
Yeah, I don't know where that was going. I don't want our listeners to panic. Jamie and I are both here, and we have lined up replacement Robs for this week and next week, who we think will fill in for him most capably. So without further ado, what say we introduce this week's guest, Rob? He is the co-writer and the letterer with Brockton McKinney of Jenny Zero, which is illustrated by Magenta King, colored by Megan Huang and Dam. It was recently collected into a trade paperback by Dark Horse Comics. Maybe you've heard of them. They must have done something right because he's back at it again with Jenny Zero 2, which comes out in just like 2 short weeks from when this episode drops. He is an 8.5 CGC copy of Transformers number 1 and the swagger to match. Dave DeWanch, it is always a pleasure to welcome you back to Marvel by the Month.
I think I need to be bitten also by a radioactive Rob at this point. I'm only 5'7 nothing, guys. It's I think all comic book writers need to be short and bearded and balding, and I got all 3 covered at this point. So
terrific. You're all set.
Nice. Yeah. Triple threat.
Oh, yeah. Man, Dave, it's so great to have you back on the show. It has been a little while.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's been a while. Last time you mentioned it earlier, but it was with our buddy Abraham. So, yeah, I miss that guy.
I know.
I only see him once a year, and it's usually at Emerald City, and he passed on the last Emerald City. So I'm hoping he's going to sneak in this year. We'll see.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we sneak in this year, too. So that would be great. I have not been to Emerald City now. It's got to be 10 years since I've gone to Emerald City, but we gotta go there. We gotta meet the people. We gotta meet the people where the people are at.
The best comic show for sure. None of that extra fluff, just all comics. It's great.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Well, Dave, congratulations on the success of Jenny Zero, and getting greenlit for the sequel, by Dark Horse. It's awesome.
Yeah, we ended that first run on a cliffhanger, and everyone was like, WTF, dude. And I'm like, well, we had a whole plan. It was going to be 5 issues. And Dark Horse is like, how about 4? And I'm like, but you're Dark Horse, so yes, of course. So we truncated everything down and then left a bunch of threads hanging that we get to address in the next volume. So we're really stoked to be able to just dive right back into it.
Nice.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And for those who are not familiar with Jenny Zero, how about you give us the elevator pitch?
Oh, God. So if Paris Hilton was a giant screw up and also a giant monster fighting giantess of a woman. So she's basically the daughter of Japan's most famous monster fighting hero who died saving the world. And she spent her entire 20s in a tailspin after her father's death, and then realizes once she sobers up that she has his powers. So she's got to maintain her sobriety to fight monsters. So it's fun. It's fun. And she's been living her entire life as a celebutante, basically just living off of the name. And so we even nodded to the Paris Hilton thing. Her best friend, who is also her agent, is heir to the Sheraton Empire of hotels. It's cute. It's fun. And the next volume is just even more bananas than the first. And, I can't say we're course correcting, but, you know, going in to year 2 of it, we definitely have our shtick down a bit. Mm-hmm. Because we had finished the first 4 issues before Dark Horse had said yes to it. So there wasn't a lot of editorial input. It was just like, yeah, we like it. We're going to do it.
Nice.
Correct these typos, you know, that kind of thing. And then with this one, it was like our editors really got involved because they realized that there was more to it. There was a more to it than just 4 issues, and it was a hit, right? So it was just something that they all eyes started turning on it after those numbers came in. So we're happy to have them.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. And the art is absolutely gorgeous. Is this so Magenta King did the art. Is this his first US comics work?
Yeah. Yeah. He actually did a lot of ghost work for Paul Pope. He was like one of Paul Pope's art assistant / anchor people. And Paul kept threatening to get us covers, man. And we were like, yes, please give us covers, Paul. And then we couldn't get the timing right. So we're hoping that potentially Paul's going to do the covers for the reprint of the volume one, if that ever happens, and then volume two for the trade, so we could keep it consistent. Kind of like a James Jean Fables kind of thing. That's what we're hoping for. We'll see.
Nice. Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. I was looking through your recent Instagram pics of your acquisitions that you are a back issue fiend.
Oh God, it is awful. It is, and it's all old school Marvel. Like some of the books that we were talking about today, I just picked up in a lot. So while I was reading it on my Kindle, I had them downstairs in my collection. I was like, just dig them out and get the old smell going, you know?
Yeah.
But my problem is I drink too much and then I get bored and I'm just on eBay all night long.
Oh, that's a dangerous combo. You got to be careful with that.
It is terrible. Did I show you this? Or hold on a second. I know this is not a video show, but Avengers 4, first cap. Yeah,
first
yeah,
Captain
yeah.
America.
So, holy cow.
Yeah, damn. I got that not that long ago. It was so weird. I had a t-shirt press and I was like, oh, you know, as an artist, as an indie creator, I was like, oh, I'm gonna make shirts, I'm gonna do all this crazy, make hats, do whatever, right? Yeah. So I had this like silkscreen press, and then it sat in a box for like literally 6 years, like I never touched it. And then as I was getting all these little comics, I'm like, how do you press comics, how do you kind of restore these books? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, they're using the same exact model of a t-shirt print press that I have, and I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna dust that off and start pressing and cleaning and restoring books. So now that's like a little secondary hobby too.
Wow.
Like I need another hobby. Right. I know, but yeah.
I've always said you have way too much time on your hands. You really need to, you know, keep yourself busier.
Well, the good news about pressing books is like once you've got them cleaned up and polished and ready for press, you could clean them all up in one evening. And then it takes like 3 hours per book. So it's not like I'm actually sitting there waiting for the water to boil, and I just gotta pop it in the oven and let it go and then come back to it later, you know?
Nice. So, nice.
Yeah.
Oh, and it doesn't take up any extra space, right? It's still at the end of the day.
Yeah. It's
the
just size in my of a garage. Comic book.
Nice.
So yeah. Man, Marvel has been my jam lately. That's all I've been doing. I started out as a Marvel kid and then a DC adult. And now I'm an ancient old man and I'm back at Marvel. So, and honestly, that would be the dream, right? That's the dream, is to write for the big two. But like,
sure.
I only have a handful of stories. Like if you were to say, go write a monthly book, I'd be like, no, not at all. I that seems like a lot of stress and a lot of work that I don't want. You know?
Do I look like John Byrne? Don't say I look like John Byrne.
And that's the thing, you know, looking at these old books, you look at all of the writers and the artists that are on it. And you're like, how the hell did they get all of these done? I know that they probably have a slush pile, and we'll talk about that one Fantastic Four issue where you've got But yeah, I mean, just to see like Gene Colan on every book, it's crazy to me.
Yeah. It's wild. I'm super excited to talk about these Marvel comics of December 1970 with you. But before we do that, let's go ahead and set the stage with a little bit of historical context. Jamie, why don't you go ahead and kick us off?
Sure. On December 1st, DC Comics Forever People number one hit newsstands. It was Jack Kirby's first new series since coming to DC. It was also an expansion of his Fourth World, which debuted a few months earlier in Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen. And the Fourth World would expand into another new series, The New Gods, when it was released on December 22nd, 1970.
Yeah. That Forever People number one is the first full Dark Side too, right? Am I crazy?
I think he had shown up in Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen is like a cameo, he was just kind of right, like shadows.
He was like literally a gangster at that point. Like there was no apocalypse. There was no anything. Like he was
the supreme lord of the Magia, is how I'm going to.
Yeah, basically. I think like he was tied in with like Morgan Edge and Intergang. But like we had no idea what the scope of what Kirby had cooking in his brain until Forever People. So
interesting.
Yeah.
You know what was cooking in his brain? Lots of drugs, probably, I want to say. That's not even a diss. That is like a thumbs up.
I think there's some people who, like, you know, like drugs activated their creativity. And then I think there's some creators whose brain just generated hallucinogenic chemicals. And I think,
you know, and potentially that was Kirby, right? Maybe he wasn't on drugs. Maybe it was just like he induced the drug use in others while reading the books.
right.
Yeah. Okay.
Matt Fraction has this theory that it's like, look, he was raising like four or five kids at this point, and he was doing, you know, five books a month. Like, he just basically didn't sleep. So, like, everything you're getting is like he's like at this liminal state of, you know, it's just like it's sleep deprivation and just like muscle memory. And it's just like the ideas are flowing out of his head because there's no time to think about anything.
And you got to think about the art style too. It's like that's when the Kirby look really took off and became something completely unique to Kirby, right? Yep. It was nuts.
It's so good.
Sorry, we derailed the year in.
I know. Yeah,
let's keep it going. Sorry.
All right. Well, on the 2nd of December, the United States Environmental Protection Agency began operations 5 months after a governmental reorganization plan had been issued by U.S. President Richard M. Nixon. And the agency's first administrator, William Ruckelshaus, was sworn into office 2 days later. I just wanted to say William Ruckelshaus.
Yeah, that's the whole point of the whole episode, was just to shoehorn in that name.
Yep, we're done. Thanks, everybody.
When someone's being rowdy at the bar, that's what I'm going to call them. Say it again.
Ruckelshaus.
Don't be a Ruckelshaus. Yeah.
On December 7th, Rube Goldberg, the American cartoonist best known for his popular cartoons depicting complicated gadgets performing simple tasks in indirect, convoluted ways, died in New York City at the age of 87. What was his cartoon character's name? Dr. Gorgonzola Butts? I think it was. I think it's Dr.
Right.
Gorgonzola Butts.
Oh, a classic.
Yeah.
I thought that was the villain in the upcoming Iron Man comic that we're going to discuss.
Well,
do you know how Rube Goldberg died?
I don't. I was actually looking that up. I mean, I didn't spend a ton of time researching it, but Wikipedia did not instantly serve it up to me, so yeah, I looked further.
It suggests a pretty low-hanging fruit kind of joke that would go there about the listeners can just assume we did that thing that seems like we would do.
Exactly. I want to assume his funeral looked a lot like the board game Mousetrap.
There we go. There it was.
It's very overcomplicated for sure.
Yeah.
Well, speaking about you know, performing simple tasks in indirect, convoluted ways, on the 9th of December, John Warren, a player for the worst team in the NBA, the Cleveland Cavaliers, that's in 1970. I'm not just calm down, Cleveland. I'm not throwing any shade. He inadvertently scored for the Portland Trailblazers in their 109-102 win at Cleveland. As the fourth quarter began with a tip-off, Warren took a pass from a teammate and raced unimpeded toward the Portland basket and made an easy layup.
Oh, no.
If that happens to you in soccer, there's a public execution. You know?
In the box score for the game, Leroy Ellis of Portland was credited with the score because he had been the last Portland player to touch the ball. And after this game, Cleveland's record in 1970 dropped to 2 wins and 28 losses.
Ooh, brutal.
Yep.
Wow. That is actually unheard of. You got to go out of your way to only win 2 games.
Yeah.
And what a nightmare. That's like the ultimate sports nightmare, right? Like, can you do anything worse than that on the playing field, really? Like, I mean,
yeah, I mean, to the point where like 52 years later, we're talking about him on a comic book podcast.
Yeah, right.
Wow. Wow.
Anyway, on December 11th, the Disney cartoon, The Aristocats, one of the most popular films of 1971, premiered in theaters. The animated movie was the last project approved by Walt Disney prior to his death in 1966.
Yep. Mm. Yeah, that was the last thing Disney greenlit.
Yeah, he didn't live to see most of Disneyland, right? Or no.
Oh,
no,
Disney World.
Disney World. Yeah.
Yeah.
His brother took over and finished it.
Yep. On the 12th of December, Jennifer Connelly, the American film actress, who she's probably best known for playing Betty Ross in The Incredible Hulk.
Sure.
She was born in Cairo, New York.
She is best known for jumping on trampolines and career opportunities. Thank you. That was like my that will be forever emblazoned in my memory. Thank you, childhood. Yeah.
I remember seeing The Rocketeer in the theaters when that came out.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah. It was just like such a formative, like one of my very first film crushes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what a fabulous comic book movie, right? That was in the age when comic movies were terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a Disney. That was a Disney movie, too.
It was a Disney one. Yep.
Yeah. There you go.
Oh, that's right.
It all comes back together. Yeah.
Nice. On December 16th, which is my birthday. As construction on its upper levels continued, the World Trade Center opened for business as 25 employees of the North Tower's first two tenants reported for work at their new location.
And if you end the story there, it's a real happy story.
That's a great, yes, yes.
Yeah. It was like, leave it alone, leave it alone.
On the 21st of December, Elvis Presley was welcomed to the White House by U.S. President Richard M. Nixon. Despite the fame of both Nixon and Presley, the meeting was not reported in the media at the time and went unnoticed for more than a year. Presley volunteered to become involved with the Nixon administration's anti-drug campaigns and was very interested in getting a special badge from the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Presley also gave Nixon the gift of a commemorative World War II Colt 45 pistol, making him possibly the only civilian to approach the president of the United States with a firearm. And the photo of Nixon and Presley shaking hands in the Oval Office is the most requested photograph from the U.S. National Archives.
Whoa. To this day? Yeah, probably.
To this day. Yep.
Wow. Weird.
Yeah.
On December 31st, if that wasn't enough to tell you that the 1960s were officially over, Paul McCartney filed a lawsuit against John Lennon, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr in London to dissolve the Beatles' legal partnership. Bummer.
Yep.
Bummer.
Yeah. And I mean, to be clear, I don't think it was meant to be like, I don't think there was any hostility. I think it was just like, this is a thing that has to happen.
You know? Right, right.
So it was like a legal technicality. But yeah, if the Beatles were officially broken up as of the end of 1970.
Well,
so.
It's good that Rob wasn't here for that one. We just won't tell him.
Yeah. I mean, I think right. I don't know if he could have continued. Yeah. Yeah. I think he still thinks they're together.
Yeah.
So
yep.
Let's not disabuse him. Well, that's you
gotta next tell him and then cue up the Incredible Hulk TV show. Yeah, watch him mope off.
Oh man, well, that's a little glimpse of what was going on in the world of December of 1970. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll talk about the Marvel Comics of December 1970 right here on Marvel by the Month. This season, increasingly against my better judgment, each episode of Marvel by the Month is being sponsored by one of 1970s Marvel's own advertisers. Jamie, Rob is out this week. It's up to you to read the sponsor copy. I apologize in advance for making you do this.
That's okay. All right, here goes. Science fiction, physics, and math. These were the making of rocket scientist Robert H. Goddard. Born in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1882, this pioneer of American rocketry read all the books by Jules Verne and H.G. Wells that he could get his hands on. As a young man, he realized that if a way to navigate space were to be discovered, it would be through physics and mathematics. From 1915 to 1941, he launched many rockets.
Okay, I'm still waiting for the scam.
Maybe it's coming up in this next part. Live the excitement of launching your first model rocket. Start with the popular Alpha, which comes with your Esther's starter kit. Easy to prep and fly, this bird is a dependable performer right through parachute recovery.
So do you sell them to your friends or something?
No, you just cut out the coupon and send them some money.
Weird. Let me take a look at that. There's not even an exclamation point in this copy. And I think I actually learned something useful.
Yeah, that's very useful from the other ads we've been given to Rob.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm not going to complain. Thank you, Estes Rockets, for sponsoring this episode of Marvel by the Month. We are also supported each and every week by our patrons who subscribe at patreon.com/marvelbythemonth. Our Patreon supporters are the ones who actually make it possible for us to make Marvel by the Month every single week.
And everyone who supports us at the $4 a month level gets access to the Marvel by the Month bonus feed. Every episode from this season and most episodes from last season have extended versions that you can only hear if you're a Patreon subscriber.
And those extended versions have additional segments where we take deeper dives into more comics. Some of these episodes are literally twice the length of the public versions. And they feature some of our favorite guests like Elliot Kalin, Tom Brevoort, Chelsea Kane, Matt Fraction, Joe Keating, Douglas Wolk, Mark Evanier, Mike Allred. And after this episode, Dave DeWanch will be in that list.
Yeah. Nice. Nice.
And everyone who supports us at patreon.com Marvel by the Month is helping to make this show happen.
So if you like what we do, please help us to keep doing it. Head to patreon.com/marvelbythemonth and support us today. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. So I have to start this one out with an apology. As regular listeners know, for months now, we have been saying that Avengers number 69 through 71 didn't exist. That was something that we truly believed, or at least some of us did. It has come to my attention that those issues actually do exist. I've finally gotten around to reading them. And I think what you need to know for the purposes of this story is that they contain the first appearance of a supervillain team known as the Squadron Sinister, who were Hyperion, Nighthawk, Dr. Spectrum, and the Whizzer, who were very thinly veiled knockoffs of Superman, Batman, Green Lantern, and the Flash. So we're planning on covering those Avengers issues that we missed in a special episode in the not-too-distant future. In that episode, we will tell you the whole story of why we didn't think they existed. Right, Jamie?
Sorry.
All right. Moving on.
Way to shame Jamie.
He knows what he did.
I know what I did.
Okay, our story opens with Thor swinging his mighty mallet to get the Avengers home from Archon's dimension, where they fought that magic barbarian guy to a standstill last issue. So the Black Knight winds up back at Stonehenge because he's a magic Englishman. So, you know, where else are you going to go?
They're all magical. Don't downplay that.
Thor and Black Panther reappear outside of Avengers Mansion and hustle over to a Toys for Tots event where they join Captain America and Spider-Man. So that seems like that was a special request from somebody.
I felt like they should have been serving pies. Yes. I was like, you know, if the pies were at the end of that, it would have been a perfect page.
Yes. But the rest of the Avengers, Goliath, Vision, Scarlet Witch, and Quicksilver, appear as insubstantial phantoms in a world where the sun is so hot that the sidewalks are melting and the people on them are dying. And it's like horrifyingly apocalyptic.
We're barreling down on that real life. This is like the title of this is The World Is Not for Burning. And I'm like, I guess they didn't have the memo in 1970.
Yeah. Look out.
The world is not yet for burning.
Right. There you go. Question mark.
Yeah. I mean, it was seriously bringing back unpleasant memories of that crazy heat dome we had here in Portland last summer. So, yeah, not great. Quicksilver sees a newspaper that says they've traveled 2 weeks into the future. Wanda casts a hex sphere that solidifies them once again, seems to send them back to their Earth on the same day that they left it. So crisis averted, but what the hell was that? But when these four Avengers enter Avengers Mansion, the security system doesn't recognize them. And Nighthawk leaps down at them from the floor above. These Avengers remember him from the Squadron Sinister, but he doesn't remember them.
It's a real Back to the Future 2 kind of situation. Like, front door is locked. He goes back to the window, and
Jamie was like, "I don't remember them either. I don't remember."
Nighthawk is outnumbered, so he slips through a secret passageway. The Avengers follow him, and that's when they encounter four more heroes in a back room of this mansion. American Eagle, Tom Thumb, Lady Lark, and Hawkeye, but not that Hawkeye. And so these are, of course, four more Justice League doppelgangers. Do you, either of you want to do the honors for who is who?
Oh, not me. I mean, obviously, what was her name? She's definitely like a Black Canary.
Yeah, Lady Lark is Black Canary.
Right,
yep.
Right.
I mean, the guy with the eagle mask seems like he's Super America. That's probably Captain Super America. And then the little guy with the metal thing, he's a troll lad, troll beard lad. And then
that's my Tinder profile name. Thank you.
And then, you know,
my
Hawkeye.
Wife's out there going like, what are they talking about?
Yeah. And then that one guy's named Hawkeye. That's real weird. What's that about? Yeah.
So are, American Eagle he's Hawkman. He's like the Marvel version of Hawkman. Tom Thumb is the Atom. Lady Lark is Black Canary, and Hawkeye is Green Arrow, which I think is great because like Hawkeye is very clearly just like a palette swap of Green Arrow for the Marvel universe. So the fact that like Roy Thomas had the balls to say, it's like, no, our Justice League knockoff guy is called Hawkeye.
Yeah. Bold move.
Yeah.
Way to rip yourself off.
Yeah, right.
We don't have a Hawkeye right now, right? So we've got Goliath. We throw a Hawkeye in here.
Yep. So yeah, of course, first rule of superhero encounters, they have to fight because they misread each other's intentions. During this fight, Dr. Spectrum sends a video message to his teammates in Cosmopolis. First of all, he says that they are in the city of Cosmopolis, which that's not where Avengers Mansion is located. And then he refers to his teammates as the Squadron Supreme, not Sinister. So that's also a switch. And we learn that he and Hyperion and the Wizard are preparing to launch Brainchild 1 into solar orbit, which is a rocket that will gather valuable data for Earth scientists. And so Vision puts two and two together because he's got that big robot brain. He realizes that they are in a parallel world. And the glimpse of the burning Earth that they saw 2 weeks in the future has got to be this world after something goes wrong with the Brainchild 1 rocket. And the Avengers decide they have to stop it, but the Squaddies aren't about to let them disrupt the launch of their important science rocket. So more fighting.
Yeah, that's a real moral high horse that they were able to get on. Like, because, I mean, it must have been really tempting to be like, not really our problem. Like, best of luck with your soon-to-be-on-fire planet. We're going to go back to our place where it's chill and go, all our heroes are cool.
All our heroes are cool. That's amazing.
So the Avengers emerge victorious. And then Goliath has the line of the issue where he refers to the ersatz Green Arrow as a Cockney carbon copy of the one and only Hawkeye. Just rubbing their nose in it.
You know what I noticed about this, and maybe it was kind of apparent as I started reading more and more of the comics from this month and this era. Yeah. It's either everyone talks like a hooligan or a super scientist or like a god, right?
Yeah.
Like even like Black Knight, you're like, why are you talking like that? And then you've got like Hawkeye and you're like, I know that you came and you were a villain to begin with, but I mean, step up your game. You know, you've been a hero for years now, right?
Yeah.
But he's still just like rough and tumble. Like, oh, yep. It's really strange.
He's dropping G's left and right at the end of his, at the end of every word.
Yeah.
He just absolutely blew the apostrophe budget for this issue.
And then you've got like Nighthawk, who's, you know, your Batman anagram or whatever. And he's talking the same way. And I'm like this, if this is the Batman of the Marvel universe, we got to refund some tickets here. This is not going to make any money at the box office. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yep. Well, so let's see. The issue wraps up with the Avengers grabbing Nighthawk. They take off for Atomic City to stop the launch of the rocket. And then the last panel is pretty ambiguous. It kind of makes it look like the devastation has already happened. But that is not the case. So don't worry yet. everything's going to be maybe okay.
And then the foreboding next issue, warning to all parents, enter death disguised as a child.
Yikes.
Don't have children. It is the slow death, my friends.
I feel like when Roy Thomas, like when he gets into his groove, he fits a ton of story into like a really small space. And there's so many characters in this issue, but I feel like he actually did a really good job of juggling everything pretty well.
Yeah, we give him a hard time where it's warranted, and it's not warranted here. This is like a very respectable comic book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and coming off of the Fantastic Four, I read them in order as you sent them to me. And so it was literally like a palate cleanser from the flashback.
Right.
It's like, wow, a linear story that makes sense. Got it.
Oh, my God. Beginning, middle, and end. Oh,
yeah. What a treat. You don't have to choose.
Yeah, and Squadron Supreme has always been a favorite of mine. Like, when I was in 1988, I'd have to do the math on this, but I was just a young buck boy, and I went to a convention in Oakland, like a WonderCon. It was like the third one or something like that. And Mark Gruenwald was there, and Mark Gruenwald was writing Captain America at the time. And I brought this comic book with me, and it's that one where Steve Rogers quits, right? And I had him sign it, and he was like, there's a misprint on the first page of this, like there's some extra ink or something. And he had a an assistant with him, because I didn't realize that he was the editor-in-chief at Marvel too. I just thought he was writing Captain America. I had no idea. I was like a little kid.
Sure.
And he was like, hey, go find this kid another copy of this comic book. And the guy was like, ugh, fine. And then so I'm standing there, like, literally, look, I don't know what I'm supposed to do right now. Like, what am I gonna do? And he's like, so what do you want to do with your life? And I was like, I want to write and draw comic books. And he was like, well, why don't you sit down and we'll talk about how that's done for as long as it takes for this guy to come back with this comic book, right?
Whoa.
So for an hour and a half, me and Mark Gruenwald just talk about writing Captain America. And it's why Captain America is like my guy. Like, Mark Gruenwald was like the hugest influence on my life. And you know, we literally talked about panel structure, storytelling, editing, everything, right? And then I just dove deep into it as an artist, and then realized, oh, I just wanted to tell stories. And I blame Mark Gruenwald for all of that. So then, you know, the Squadron Supreme, the legendary trade paperback with his ashes in it and all this stuff. I was just on a panel with Howard Mackey, the guy who wrote that Gambit miniseries. He's written a Ghostwriter, you know, the Danny Ketch stuff. We were like next to each other. I was all these old Marvel guys and me, and it was like how to publish comics 101. And I'm like, you guys are ill-equipped to do. You guys have been sucking on sweet air for way too many years. I'm the only one here that actually knows how to self-publish and get your stuff made. So, you know, I'm talking about all these old codgers, but I tell the Gruenwald story, and he was like, what year was it? I was like, I think it was 87 or 88. He's like, good, because in 89, I was his assistant and I would have had to be the person to go looking for that stuff. But he was like, Mark is the nicest dude ever. My kids called him Uncle Mark. And then I got to meet Howard's kids at the convention. They were like, yeah, Uncle Mark was the best. And I'm like, Uncle Mark was my Uncle Mark for like a day.
Yeah.
And the influence that he had on me was so like fundamentally me, you know, he made me to have him in their lives for as long as he was there. I can't imagine that influence, man.
Wow.
Just a great dude. And if anyone was watching not WandaVision, the Loki show, that one character is him.
Mobius.
Mobius is him. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, yeah. So Squadron Supreme has always had a huge impact on me, and I had never read this issue. I'd only read the miniseries.
Wow. Yeah.
So this was fun to see Squadron Sinister be Supreme. Right. Yeah. And to not be the villains, in this.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is like, to me, this is actually like coming home for the first time, but I've been here forever. Right.
Yeah.
So I loved it. I love this issue so much.
I love that story. And yeah. I mean, anytime I can get a Mark Gruenwald story out of anyone, like, they can have the floor as long as they want. Like, I think in my real formative comics reading life, I think he probably had as much of an influence. Like, I mean, he's probably one of the main reasons I'm a Marvel Comics fan. Like, I loved his Captain America. I loved Squadron Supreme and his Quasar. Like, I think Quasar is like a totally underappreciated comic, but like, he would just, he was a master of telling the kind of story where he would just like find a plot thread. Like, everything he wrote was like a no prize attempt. It was amazing. Like, he would like be constantly fixing little glitches in continuity. And that's why the Mobius character is based on him. But like, he just had such an encyclopedic knowledge, but also just like a love of the entire Marvel universe. And like, he got the idea of, I mean, he was like, he always wanted to like make things fit and make things make sense, but like, he never lost track of how to tell a really great story. You know, it, like he, his characters were very strong. Like, the motivations were just so well defined. And yeah, he was wordy as hell, which is a habit I had to break because I read a lot of Mark Gruenwald comics.
Well, that was the fashion at the time too, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
It's like, these books are, I mean, they take at least twice as long to read as a modern comic. And that's definitely not a bad thing. I've, you know, like, at a certain point as a writer, you have to realize that some people are reading your comics on the toilet, right? I mean, like, comics take, like, you know, a good comic, someone will actually be on the toilet the entire time, even though they're not on the toilet the entire time, if you know what I'm saying. But like, but like, you're still talking about 20 minutes at best, right? Like, these comics take 30, 35 minutes if you're really paying attention to the art and the story and how it works. And I feel like this is the establishment of the art form minus that Fantastic Four hatchet job, right? I mean, because like, to me, I feel like if someone did that to me, I'd be gone. And if it was an FU after I was gone, I would never, ever come back. Forget it, you know? Yeah, it's crazy.
Sweet.
I feel like I just drained all emotion out of you. That's so amazing. I love it.
Like, I mean, I'm just like, yeah, I am so happy and jealous of you and for you, like, that you got to spend that time with someone like that.
That's such a crucial moment too. Like,
there are only like three heroes in my life and I've only met one of them, right? But like, you know, the deaths that affect you, the one, you know, like, when I got word that Mark passed away, I was so bummed. And you know, the internet wasn't a thing, and then you find out how painful and how awful it was and how he held his head up high, and you're just like, that's a hero, man. That, and to me, that's the perfect Captain America writer, right? He had his head up high the entire time, he never gave in. You know, and then, you know, obviously, like, for me, music's big, but like, Prince and Freddie were like huge for me. Sure. And I took the days off, but when Mark passed away, I was inconsolable for a lot longer than when Prince passed away. And that's saying a lot about Mark, right?
Sure.
He was that talented. So I mean, anyone listening to this, go back and read Squadron Supreme, read that Captain America stuff. A lot of the stuff that, was the foundation for the Marvel stuff is in there. It really is.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of people forget, like, Squadron Supreme came out before Watchmen did.
Oh yeah. Like,
I mean, he was doing what if superheroes existed in the real world and decided that they could fix all the problems and run things better than normal people.
I mean, and that's how I felt about Kingdom Come when I read it. I was like, wow, this just feels like some Squadron Supreme stuff right now. I mean, like,
interesting.
It's different. But at its core, it's exactly what you're describing, Brian. So it's the foundation for sure.
Yeah. So we'll leave you to chew on that one while we take what I think is going to be our final break of the episode. So don't go away. I mean, we may get some more anecdotes about legends that Dave has met.
Man, don't get me started. Don't get me started. Commercial break <right. me. laughs>
We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month. All All right. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Jamie, I've got some bad news. It's the same bad news I have at this point of the show every week. We are way over time. We still have another 8 stories to cover this month. So you know what that means. It is time to make like the Wizard and enter the lightning round that is Marvel by the Minute. It's Marvel by the Minute. The rules are simple. We get 1 minute to cover each remaining story. Once that minute is up, we move on to the next issue. Dave, even though you are substitute Rob, we're going to treat you better than we treat him. You don't have to participate in any of this nonsense unless you want to.
Half the price and half the size. Let's do this.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see. Jamie, how about we start out with you, and we'll have you talk about the Black Widow story in Amazing Adventures number 5. The story is called And to All a Good Night. It's written by Roy Thomas. The art is by Gene Colan and Bill Everett. I'm putting your 60 seconds on the clock. You may begin.
All right. On a snowy winter night, a young lad is probably committing suicide by jumping off a bridge when he's saved by a green shirted man who holds up a picture of a card that has a picture of a Black Widow on it. And he brings the kid to the Black Widow's place, and she's showering for some reason. And then gotta stay clean. The guy's name is Ivan. Ivan brings the kid to the Black Widow's place, and she's gonna help him out. He has fallen in with a bad crowd, who's their Zodiac crime people. But then the Zodiac crime people they attack the Black Widow's apartment, and she's fighting them off, and it's actually going pretty well. But then up on the roof where the kid has been escaping to, he actually falls or is pushed. I'm not exactly sure, but she does not save him, and the kid falls to his death. And Black Widow is very upset, and her man friend is trying to console him, and she calls the police and says it's a suicide. That's pretty close.
I mean, yeah, except that was only 10 pages. You're screwed on the next one, buddy.
Yeah. Right. Every week I like pat myself on the back for getting a 10-page story down in 60 seconds.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't like that it was a suicide that then became a justified suicide at the end of that story. But go ahead, let's keep going.
Yeah, right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in that one. I don't know how they got through the comics code. Like there's some real racy panels of Black Widow, and then a dude jumps off the building at the end, and everyone just seems a little sad, but not too broken up about it. So
it's another beautiful looking Gene Colan issue, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I am going to take us through Amazing Spider-Man number 94. The story is called On Wings of Death, written by Stan Lee. Well, it doesn't actually break down writing and artist. It just says by Stan Lee, John Romita, and Sal Buscema.
Are you going to start that timer?
I'm going to start the timer. Right.
You're cheating already.
No. Okay, so this one's easier. So it starts out with Peter moping around about Gwen moving to England. Then we get a recap of his origin that goes on for quite a while. Then we get a splash page of all the different enemies he's fought. And we're like almost halfway through the story at this point. It recaps his relationship with Betty Brant falling apart because of Spider-Man, and his weird relationship with Jonah Jameson. But then the Beatles shows up with his creepy little suction fingers. He's like breaking into all these different stores, which doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. He winds up kidnapping Aunt May, and Spider-Man, of course, has to go and try to save him. He finds the Beetle breaking into another store, which was sharing a wall with a bank vault. That's why he was robbing everything. He manages to get Aunt May away from the Beetle because he would never let someone fall to their death. And then he throws the Beetle in a swimming pool. The end.
Yeah.
I thought you were like doing so well. You're like, there's a flashback that takes up half the issue. Okay, let's go. And then I was like, oh, he's got this. And then you went right up to the buzzer.
Yep. It's such a dense issue. It also has like a bunch of, I think Aunt May comes off worse in this issue than she has in any other issue up to this point. Like her friends are calling her out. It's like, why are you so weird with your nephew? She's like, he's a growing boy.
I like to think that Far From Home butts it right up to the end of this issue so that you can read this issue. And then they go to the UK.
Exactly.
There we go. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Oh,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Okay, Jamie, your issue that you're going to talk about next is Captain America 135.
Oh, the faces. Oh, so many faces in this book.
More Monster Than Man. Written by Stan Lee, art by Gene Colan and Tom Palmer. Can't ask for a better team than that. You've got 60 seconds. Go for it.
Nick Fury and Dum Dum Dugan are hanging out at S.H.I.E.L.D. headquarters when Captain America shows up and he gives an intro to the Falcon and Red Wing. And they are going to get into a sparring match with Dum Dum so he can kind of prove himself. Meanwhile, there's like a science guy with kind of an ape face who's in love with a girl there, a woman there. His name's Dr. Gorbo, which is awesome. the Falcon wins the fight with Dum Dum and proves, and so S.H.I.E.L.D. is like into him now. And the Gorbo turns himself into an ape and is like an ape man, and he's just kind of psyched about that. And then he like goes to a zoo to get more ape blood to make himself an ape more, so he can get the girl to love him, kind of. There are army people. Oh, there's a science thing happening. And the ape man tries to sabotage the science thing from happening, but Cap is there to stop him. And it kind of ends. Oh, they're falling. They're going to fall into the giant hole. There's a giant hole at the science thing. And yeah. I didn't hear the ding. Did it ding?
Yeah.
It dinged.
Oh, yep. Sorry. I went over.
There was one thing where I can't remember her name. Was it Julie or whatever it is? And she's like, I joined S.H.I.E.L.D. to do good and also meet men. I was like, wow. Okay. She wanted to be just like Sharon Carter. That was weird.
Yeah. That's a Stan Lee written comic. I'm going to try to describe what happens in Incredible Hulk number 137.
Oh, good luck.
Oh man,
the stars my enemy.
I could not stay awake. I like three separate days I tried to read this, and
I call this one Planet Yawn.
It is written by Roy Thomas. We find out later, I think, that Jerry Conway contributed a story idea to it, so he's retroactively credited, not in the issue itself. The art's by Herb Trimpe and Mike Esposito. 60 seconds on the clock, and here I go. So the Hulk is in a spaceship with the Abomination. They have a fight, and Hulk is a prisoner on the ship, and he has to help row the spaceship. Just go with it. We find out that basically the commander of the Hulk actually he kind of adjusts to life on there, and he kind of likes it. He likes being part of a team. But they are
quit the Avengers in issue 2. But let's go.
So they. We find out that the commander of the ship is a guy named Cybor, who is like half robot, half man. He's got a real Captain Ahab thing going on, because he is trying to catch this like cosmic monster thing and kill it because it burned up half of him. Wackiness ensues. They find it. He burns up with it in the sun, and then like Hulk falls to Earth or something. So,
oh yeah, man. The problem with this, I mean, there are many problems with this, but there are too many aliens with alien names.
Yeah.
So you've got Klaatu and Zeron and the thing that it's chasing. Oh, Cyber or whatever.
Yep.
And the Abomination is also there, and he's like second in command. I will say this.
You gave that story. You did justice to that story very well in a minute. That's where I'm going with this. It was bananas. And I don't want to speak ill of Herb Trimpe, but like there just wasn't a lot for him to do in this. Crazy.
Yeah. I don't feel like it played to his strengths. It's Hulk in space. I didn't realize how often the Hulk went to space in like early Marvel comics.
He's basically unstoppable, and to prevent it from being the same story over and over again, you gotta toss him into space.
By the way, if Tom Brevoort is listening, I've got a Hulk story that's fucking awesome.
I'm sure he listens to every episode.
After we're done recording, I'll tell you all about it. You guys are gonna be like, why isn't that a thing yet? It's so
nice.
Good. Oh my god. Yeah, give me a Hulk story. I got it.
All right. Jamie, you get an Iron Man story.
Oh, boy.
And it's already been provided for you. You don't even have to write it.
that is convenient, I will say.
Yeah. The story is called Revenge.
I want a soundbite of you doing that on a button that we can just hit whenever we need it.
I think you should just make it a question. Revenge?
This one is written by Jerry Conway from a plot by Alan Brodsky, Marvel's token conservative, who apparently is no longer writing for Marvel. The art is by Don Hell, who, of course, is credited as Don Heck because of the Comics Code. And Mike Esposito and Herb Trimpe also contributed art to this one. So you've got your 60 seconds, and they are starting right now.
Jasper Sitwell is super hurt from recent goings on against the Zodiac people. So we get some flashback pages of that. Iron Man vows revenge. Madam Mask, who's wearing a mask on top of her mask in a disguise, is very upset to find out that Sitwell
That's
is
That's not hurt. How masks work.
Yeah. Pulling a real Daredevil. Oh, speaking of, Daredevil's in this issue. He is serving as Iron Man's lawyer or something. He's trying to calm down Iron Man because Iron Man's real angry about Sitwell. And then the spy master goes to his master, who turns out to be Capricorn, who's one of the Zodiac people. Nick Fury also is in here kicking around doing stuff. They find the Zodiac key, just like a crazy weapon thing. Iron Man encases it in like a energy thing to keep it from doing stuff. And it keeps taking over people's minds and making them do violent stuff. Oh man, that's the page 13 or 14. Daredevil, who comes back into this issue, he gets captured. He's with Madam Mask, but they also escape. Oh man, not even close. Not even close.
Well, guess what? It's a two-parter, so you're even more screwed. This is like it's a real thing.
Yeah. Does Brian get the other half? That would be convenient.
Yeah, I get. I'll get Daredevil number 73. I'll just jump right into it.
Wait, double points if you can finish where Jamie was and finish within a minute. Okay, that's the way this right. goes.
Well, yeah, I know I know they all wind up getting captured, and that's where we pick up in Daredevil.
Right, they're in tubes, classic bad guy tubes.
Yep. Oh, actually,
don't tell Karnak.
Boy, he hates a tube. So this one gets real trippy by the end, I think. That's appropriate for an episode we're recording on 420, I guess. So this is Daredevil number 73, Behold the Brotherhood, written by Jerry Conway, again from a plot by Alan Brodsky. The art's by Gene Colan and Sid Shores. I will start my 60 seconds right now. On the cover, we see Capricorn using his weird, like, head tentacle things to wrap up Daredevil. I didn't think that was a thing.
Nope.
All of our heroes from the Iron Man issue are trapped. Fury is going for the Zodiac key. We get a big flashback to most of what happened last issue. Fury grabs a Zodiac key and he zaps all the bad guys. And then that takes them to like some alternate dimension with the law holder, the high priest of Ankh. He is a member of the Brotherhood. It's sort of, I don't know. He's got some mystical power through the Zodiac thing. They fight a third of the Zodiac. Yeah, and it gets concluded next month in Iron Man.
is this warranted of a three-part story? Because it's crazy.
This is this has been a 5 or 6-part story, when it's all said and done. So
like the Ankh thing, and then you had the astronomer from the Black Widow story, and it was like too many of the same kind of like odd spiritual sign characters, right?
Yes. Really
at the same month.
Maybe really that odd. Was just the hot thing back in this month. We should look back and be like, well, when did that become a thing? When did being a Scorpio mean I was passionate? I don't know.
Yeah. Also, I gotta say, there's only a handful of Zodiac folks in both of those issues, but like one of them is Capricorn. He's like the main bad guy. And then Sagittarius is also there, which represents all three regular hosts of Marvel by the month. So I'm kind of feeling singled out here.
But you know what? I will say one thing about this issue over the last one. Well, mm-hmm. Two things. The dialogue for Iron Man, while all of it seemed really like stunted and cheesy and dated, I could actually hear Robert Downey Jr. saying these things, and it was completely acceptable in my mind.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
Yeah. Which is weird. And then was it Capricorn, the guy with the ears?
The tentacle.
Yeah. I was like, what a dumb looking character in the first one. And then when Gene Colan got a hold of him, I was like, what a cool looking character.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's night day, right?
That's that Colan magic. Yep.
It really is. Don't say that. Side effects include.
Just isolate that soundbite. Make it your ringtone.
That's for your Patreon, by the way.
There you go.
Color magic. Side effects include listening to Dave talk on a friggin' podcast.
All right, Jamie, you just got one more to do. Yours is going to be Submariner number 35.
Oh, I feel bad. You're such a Defenders fan. Sorry about that. I guess
that's okay. Crumbles. Nope. I'm fine sitting this one out. Submariner number 35. The story is called Confrontation, written by Roy Thomas, art by Sal Buscema and Jim Mooney. 60 seconds. Give it a shot. Go.
Silver Surfer, Submariner, and Hulk are all in a tentative alliance in order to stop a science project that is going to possibly cause damage based on some Atlantean science. They're confronting the army. The army doesn't really want to hear about it. So they're trying to like duke it out with them. But then the Avengers show up. So now there's a lot of characters in the story. And Dorma is still, the wedding is still kind of on, and she's kind of in the background. That comes into play later. The Avengers and what we'll call the proto defenders start duking it out. It's actually a pretty fun fight scene where everyone kind of teams up, you know, do the respective battles. Goliath gets knocked out by Namor underwater, and then Namor, in a noble moment, kind of saves him. Meanwhile, Dorma jumps in between and gets the army people to stop fighting the superhero people for long enough for everyone to explain what's going on. And then they convince them that they do need more time to see if the science thing will work. And then the Hulk is like, screw this, I'm out of here. And they leave in peace.
Terrific. And that's how climate change was prevented.
Yay. Glad we fixed that before it became a problem.
Yep. We're creeping ever closer to the debut of the Defenders. We got 3 out of 4.
And Dorma.
Is that Marvel feature number one? Or is
Yep. Oh, I think so. Yeah.
Wow, well done.
Yep. And yeah, I think it's just like less than 6 months away at this point. So.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Hey, Dorma did something useful in this issue.
Yeah, she did. She wasn't just a hostage.
Yeah, she was a real Chekhov's Dorma in this case.
Yes.
Well played.
Thanks. Yep. Thanks. I've had that one chambered all week.
Okay, I'm going to take us out with Thor number 185, In the Grip of Infinity.
Oh, yeah.
It's written by Stan Lee. The art is gorgeous, and by John Buscema and Sam Granger. I will start my 60 seconds now. So we have been promised the world beyond. Finally, Thor is in the world beyond. It's all very cosmic. He's looking for his dad to help him out. Still worried about that Odin sword becoming unsheathed. There's stuff going on all over the world. First, Thor has to get past the Guardian, who's like this four-armed big troll guy. Thor can take him. It's not a big deal. Thor mentions the name Infinity, and a booming voice rockets around the world. We see a giant hand reach out, a cosmic hand, and crush a planet. Then Thor is wandering through some mists. There's like a creepy zombie-looking dude. More crazy special effects with Infinity. The creepy zombie-looking dude points Thor in a direction. He sees zombified versions of his friends, and they're worried about Ragnarok. He comes across Odin, and it's all set up for the next issue.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. It is. And by the end of it, he turns back into lame Dr. Blake, of course, because that's what the kids want to see. Not that superhero, just, you know, his weaselly little alter ego.
I liked Blake back in the day when I was a kid. I thought every superhero or god had a secret identity, so it wasn't like a weird thing for me.
Yeah,
yeah.
I like this. I think this. I'm totally compelled by the Infinity thing, whatever it is. It's giant black hand.
Yeah.
I love the silent guy, the silent.
Yes. That character design is so spooky.
He looks awesome. And he is just around. Like, yeah, he's been in the last three issues not saying anything, just like in the background being creepy and sometimes pointing at stuff. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah.
The scale of the sword, like, you can't even tell how big the sword is.
Yeah.
It like goes all the way to the horizon. Like, it's just impossibly large. Like, this thing's like, whatever's going on is like kind of taking down Odin, it seems. It's super intriguing.
I was worried that when we lost Kirby, we were going to like lose a lot of the cosmic stuff too. But I mean, this is just, it's so big. And it's just so, yeah, it gets across that sense of you just can't wrap your mind around it all. It's really great. And it's beautiful. It's so beautiful to look at.
Would you say that Buscema's run on Thor is his defining role on anything? Or I feel like that's the guy that was that should have been on Thor the entire time. He's just amazing on this book.
He's incredible on Thor. I mean, it's that. I mean, there's some folks who probably say Conan, but I think because like Barry Windsor Smith came first, like the Conan kind of feels like the Barry Windsor Smith book, and then Buscema did a very good job on it after, like, you know, picking up. But I mean, yeah, his work on Thor is just,
it's next level.
It's like, next level.
It's so taking good. It's taking Marvel from the 60s to the 70s. Like, yes. That's yeah. I mean, and honestly, for all of its gripes with that Fantastic Four issue, that's what that was doing too, right? Like, yep. Like, I don't love it that they did that, but at the same time, it really did it transition Marvel into the 70s, which is cool.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's the comics of December 1970. The only thing left for us to do now is to share our astonishing takes, our recommendations for what our listeners might want to check out that are not Marvel comics from December of 1970. I'm going to lead off with, I think, a pretty non-controversial recommendation. I'm going to recommend Daredevil by Brian Michael Bendis and Alex Maleev.
Hogwash. No, this
is the series that got me back into reading Marvel comics after I walked away from Marvel for a while in the early 90s. I just wound up going back to it. I've read Bendis and Maleev's run on Daredevil several times, but I came back to it recently after listening to our podcast friends. Screw it, we're just going to talk about comics. They were talking about Frank Miller's Daredevil Born Again, and it was so much fun to kind of like hear them and their takes going through it. And look, I'm a big Frank Miller fan. Like Frank, I am a proud native Central Vermonter. But I think Bendis's run on Daredevil might be the high water mark for the character.
Oh, cool.
It's like, I mean, yeah, and Daredevil has been a character that has absolutely punched above its weight with creative teams and excellent writers. But I just feel like Bendis and Maleev did such a good job of stripping the series down to like its street level roots, which has been done, you know, by other teams in other eras. But like, he just combined the naturalistic dialogue and really explosive plot twists, especially in that first third of the run. You know, I know there's like fans of old school, like Marvel comic storytelling that are not wild about the, you know, the decompressed storytelling that he's associated with, and really helped to popularize in getting creators to start thinking about writing for the trade. But like at that point in my life, I was already like focusing on like reading things in volumes, not issue to issue. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I think he really just kind of transformed the way that Marvel approached storytelling.
He also did the Illuminati, right? Which is going to be a hot button topic with Doctor Strange. And that is some revisionist history that is decompressed and yet very compressed, right? I actually like Bendis's Marvel stuff more than his DC stuff. And that's just, for some reason, he just nailed those characters. And Daredevil is one of those perfect characters for him.
Yeah,
you know, it's like if he were to write Punisher, I could see it being amazingly just awesome. But, you know, he's a street level guy. So him doing Daredevil is like, I see why you would love that.
Coming straight out of like his doing his own crime comics and then doing Daredevil as a crime comic, which is, I think, where the character works best. I mean, it's when what Miller did. It works great when Brubaker did it, you know. So, and, you know, like I can make a case for Bendis, like, maybe being the second most important writer of Marvel Comics after Stan Lee. Like,
yeah,
I think
I agree with that.
With when he came in and what he did, like, I mean, just between like Daredevil, Illuminati, New Avengers, and Ultimate Spider-Man, like, I think
and not for nothing, the Jessica Jones run.
The Jessica Jones run, for sure.
Sparked the Netflix, you know, that went to Netflix and then like brought in all those people.
Yeah. And then like kind of like retroactively inserted her into the universe, you know, like in a way where she feels like a totally organic part of it. But
yeah, it's like they did a really good version of Sentry. They were like, right.
And he brought Luke Cage back to like popularity and establishes him as like an A-tier character.
I mean, what he did around that time, I mean, I really think of it as the birth of the like centralized, cohesive Marvel universe of like modern times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it felt in the good ways, it felt like the glory days of sort of like the mid to late 80s Marvel, where like everything felt very connected. It felt like the shooter era, but not constricted the way that the shooter era felt. So,
well, and like, and when things crossed over, it wasn't like, oh, this doesn't really work because they couldn't be here because of X, Y, Z. Like suddenly people's locations made sense, like chronologically and cross.
Sure.
You could just tell there was a big board somewhere in a way that there hadn't been for a long time.
Yep. For sure. Jamie, what do you got for a recommendation?
So I wanted to take a break from recommending either X-Men stuff or Chelsea Kane stuff. I picked something I loved and I was like flipping through it to see, you know, what I would talk about. And it turned out Chelsea Kane wrote the introduction to the trade.
You just can't get away from that, girl.
I cannot get away. So I would like to recommend Lady Killer by Joelle Jones and Jamie S. Rich and Michelle Madsen. Are you familiar with it at all?
No.
It's a, like a 1950s homemaker, who like does all the things like perfectly. And it's it beautiful and poised and like 50s presentational. But then she also has a secret life as like a bloody murderer, a secret assassin person. it was nominated for best limited series, for the Eisner Awards in 2016. And Jones was nominated for both best penciler, inker, and cover artist.
Oh,
so
nice.
It, like, has a, it's a, the pedigree is really strong. The art is stunning. As listeners know, I'm a coward. I'm just a fraidy cat. I don't like scary things. I don't like gross things. But the covers of these, like, I could not look away.
Like Roadkill. You're driving by. You're like, oh,
right,
that's a nightmare. Right.
Yeah, more. Give me more of that.
You're on my watch list now, Jamie. But that's
fair enough. I'd be surprised often I hear that. The aesthetic is something very specific, and I'm sure there's a name for what they're doing here, but I couldn't tell you what it is. It looks almost animated. It has kind of like there's like a thick black line, but it's like 50s, so everything's like it's just so presentational and elegant and like clean, which is then contrasted with these like shockingly gritty murders and everything's like blood splatters. It plays a lot with like the contrast between those two extremes, both like kind of visually and thematically, I guess. At the time I thought it was clever that like the title Lady Killer wasn't a killer of ladies, but a lady who was doing the killing. And I was like, oh, that's so great. And like looking at it now, I was like, oh, it's filled with stuff like this. Like that's the point of this thing. So there's a ton of like really fun and really smart like trope subversions, and like it's an awesome like really black comedy kind of thing.
Very cool.
Yeah, highly recommend.
Dave, what do you got to recommend to our listeners?
I mean, I have to be a shill, right? I've got to be like, look,
go shill it up. If ever there was a time, it's now.
Go pick up Jenny Zero Volume 1. And then Volume 2 is coming out next month. Well, I don't know when this is airing, but probably like right up against it. We're doing some crazy stuff and it's going to blow your minds. It blows my mind. Like, I'm like, who wrote this? By the way, when the art comes in, I'm like, who the hell drew this? Like, all of my dreams are coming true right now.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I get to write it with my best friend, Brockton McKinney, who you guys got to get him on the show. He's the most hilarious Paul Ruddy and charming son of a bee on the planet. Like, I was like, baby, I'm straight as hell, but I got a crush on this guy. And my wife's like, I don't see it. I showed her a picture. and she was like, I don't get it. And then she hung out with him. She's like, I get it. That guy is awesome. He's just like a joy to be around. On top of that, shouting out to other friends, I would have to say, if you haven't picked up Image Comics, Stray Dogs by Tony Fleece and company.
Yes.
Tony's a good friend. And we hung out a couple weeks ago. The story revolves around a bunch of dogs who are taken trophy after a serial killer kills their masters. And then it unfolds in a murder mystery Seven kind of way, drawn Disney style. And all told from the dog's points of view. I don't want to spoil it. It's awesome. And he probably doesn't need my help on this one. It's just so good that I think everyone should pick it up.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
We had Tony on the show, I think, right as the series was coming out. And I mean, having him on as a guest was great. We found out that at one point, I think he owned a copy of Silver Surfer number 3 for like 10 minutes because he'd bought it for, I want to say like he paid $8 for it at the local comic book store. And then he showed his mom and she was outraged that a comic book store.
Was that Mephisto?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I've been looking for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't find it.
She was outraged that a comic store would charge a little kid $8 for a comic book and she made them give him his money back. So yeah, so that's my Tony Fleece story.
All right, I'm gonna remove this. Let's give screw you, Tony. You gotta stand up for yourself. let's go with Dennis Culver, who is working on Batman Future State, but he also did a book. It's 420 today.
Yes.
And he did a book called Burnouts that I lettered for Image, about a bunch of it's an alien invasion, a kind of They Live style, but the only time that kids can see them is when they're high. So the only people that can see the aliens are stoners.
Oh, nice. What a great premise.
And it's called Burnouts. I think that everyone should read that. We did 5 issues of that. And Dennis and Jaffa, who did the art, who's doing a lot of layouts for Marvel. No, I think he's doing layouts for Marvel now. He's a layout artist, but he should definitely have his own series. I don't know why they haven't hired him for his own series. He's badass. But yeah, Burnouts was like phenomenal. When I found out about that series, I was like, please let me letter it. Like, I don't need to be creative on it, but yeah. I want to letter it for sure. So yeah, that was a fun book. And Dennis is a great friend. Like I said, Tony's a great friend too, but Tony doesn't need your money. Give that to Dennis.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us again. It is always such a blast to have you on and talking Marvel Comics and literally anything with you. You're a gentleman and a scholar and really appreciate it. And so happy for the success of Jenny Zero. You totally deserve it.
I don't know if that, you know what, we're all going to live in imposter syndrome land forever. I mean, I don't think until I get that Bendis money, I am no one. I'm just like, whatever. Robotech, please.
There you go. Listen, Titan Books, give this man Robotech.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Hey, everybody listening to the sound of my voice. Did you know that you can subscribe to our Patreon for the fantastic price of $4 a month at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth and get exclusive content, including a longer version of this episode? We love your Apple Podcast reviews or whatever you use to listen to us.
Hey, and I made a point of stopping interrupting Brian when he does this at the end because I know it's super annoying to him. But I also noticed that our reviews have not been ticking up at the same rate. So I think to go back to interrupting you because, dude, my wife's podcast has like, they're like 1,000 or pushing 1,000 reviews.
Whoa. Rewind this. You got to pump her podcast. What is this podcast?
Oh, she doesn't need our help. It's the Resolve Mysteries podcast where they recap and do research and resolve the episodes of Resolve Mysteries.
What? That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it is that they have such a successful thing on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. But then I go and check our stuff, and then I get real sad.
Yeah, it's really leading, I would say. Would you say that it's leading to, like, disruption in your marriage?
Oh, I mean, that would probably be underselling it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, folks, really, Jamie could use your help here.
Yeah, if you care about my marriage, and I know you do.
Yeah. My wife has been on the podcast several times, but she doesn't care about our ratings. So do it for Jamie. Yeah. Do it for Jamie. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And hey, if you leave us a 5-star review, you take a screenshot of that and you send it to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. I will put some free stuff in the mail to you if you also give me your mailing address. That's a crucial part of the thing. That
and
many
it's true.
People
he
forget.
Really does it. He really does it.
I really do it. Yep. Jamie has seen the envelopes. Hey, you can also find us on Instagram at Marvel by the Month and Twitter at MarvelBTM, and MarvelByTheMonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. That's all for now. My name's Brian Stratton.
I'm Jamie Wenger.
And we'll see you next week for next month. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, stay inside and read comics.